I saw that you were nearly a Clarence Jr. That's a fun story that relates to your father's birthday.
Well, my mother loved telling that story. She as much as she loved my dad, she thought that one Clarence was enough. She never cared for the name.
Well, there's a lot that's been said about your father, including some you know, famous people, Martin Luther King Jr., President Jimmy Carter, Millard Fuller, Dorothy Day. Lots of well-known figures have praised and spoken very highly of your father. But, you know, for you, he was your dad. And so I'm curious about, what can you tell us about Clarence that's not the influential figure, the famous person, but was just a person?
Well, I think my dad tried to give us as normal a life as possible. And he was gone a lot speaking. And one of the things that we got to do was certainly to travel with him to some of those speaking engagements. But more than that, I think he really wanted to give us the confidence to go forth and make our own decisions. Daddy and Mom really worked as a team. And while my dad was out doing speaking engagements a lot of the time, my mother was holding the household together. And we really ended up responding a lot more to her from a discipline standpoint. She would she was the disciplinarian, and it was only the threat of when Daddy got home that we would have worse consequences for whatever transgressions we had. But beyond that, I think the one thing that Daddy tried to do was to give us a sense of what really was important in life and in making decisions. It was something that we didn't realize, and it could probably be boiled down in a couple ways. One, certainly his spiritual background and all was important in our life, but he also, because of what he believed in terms of living a simple life, he gave us something we've not been able to replicate with our own kids, and that is poverty. And not that we ever thought we were poor, because we never realized that, but we realized we had enough and no more. And one of the things that made that come to life for me was we always had guests coming to the farm, and my mom and the others that prepared meals were thinning the soup, so to speak, to the point that it was pretty thin already. And one day I brought one of my friends from school home, and it happened to be dinner time, and my mother kind of got to the side and, without my friend hearing, saying, you know, we really don't have enough to eat. And at that point, my dad was there, and he said, you know, he says, I need to go out and check on the cattle. I'm not really hungry.
Wow.
And I've never forgotten that incident, where it was an act of selflessness. And I've tried to remember that when occasions have come up, but it's something that I've not been able to duplicate, that type of thing, with my own kids. So that's just one example of a lesson, I guess, that we as kids learned through example. And I think that's the way Daddy wanted to live his life, was not being someone, but living as someone.
That seems to fit so well with a lot of the statements he made, particularly during the period of violence in 56 and 57, about the idea of staying put and living despite all of the attacks, the machine gun fire, the dynamite, this idea of simply living as the witness. And I wonder, and I know you were a very young child during that most violent time period, but what was life like at Koinonia during those darker days?
Well, you know, even as young as I was, The things that stick in my mind were when we were out playing as kids, we were instructed without really instilling fear. And I to this day, I don't know why we didn't act in fear, but it was we were told that if cars came by, you either got behind the tree or you laid down on the ground. We didn't realize that firewood was stacked on the sides of houses, not because we needed firewood. In fact, we really didn't use much firewood at that point. But it was to, you know, to stop bullets. But beyond that, living in community was fun. There were other kids, and it wasn't until the community had been destroyed by the boycott and the violence that we realized how different life was. When there were many families there were many kids our age, and we had lots of things to do. But it was after that the impact really hit home. And so even as a 5, 6, 7 year old kid later on, it took its toll later in our lives than at the point of the attacks and the boycott.
Yeah. You know, as I was going through the archives in Georgia, I happened to run across the yearbook for your senior year in high school. It was there in the collection. And it seemed to remind me of a pretty important part of the story is the freedom that you and your siblings were given to make some decisions and make your own courageous stands. Because there's something that's pretty significant, it seems, about your yearbook, that you're the only white face among the pictures of the smiling graduates. Can you tell us a little bit about that story and how that came about?
Well, that was a time, and I guess now that you mention it, we probably were given more say in some of the things that happened than we realized at the time. But I actually, in my eighth grade year, was sent away because of the violence and the threat of violence in the schools. And it was during that year that I was homesick for Koinonia and for my family, obviously. And David Whitcamper and I communicated during that year. He had been sent away also. And we said, we want to come home. We know we can't go to America's High, but why don't we go to Sumter High? And we proposed that to our parents, and they, I think, thought about it. They were not happy because even though that was a period of separate but equal schools, their fear was that it was not equal. And in many ways, from an educational curriculum standpoint, it was far from equal. But having the opportunity to be with friends that happened to be a different race didn't matter. I mean, color was invisible to us. And so we had a great time, and I had a great 4 years. And if you saw the yearbook, I served on the yearbook committee, and the only thing I didn't know was that was the year my dad passed away, that they planned to insert that full page picture and inscription, which I didn't see until the yearbooks were delivered to the school.
You know, that you're talking about education and the issue of separate but not equal. And I think that's perhaps a part of your father's legacy that is not as well known. His long struggle to help improve the education for minorities, going back to his days in Louisville when he was working in a teaching in a seminary for African-American ministers. And that was one of the early efforts at Koinonia, was a hope to be able to provide education for African-American pastors. I don't know if that's something you could talk to a little bit about that issue and how that resonated in his life's work.
Well, I think Daddy always thought, and again, just looking at his education, he believed strongly in education. And I think in some ways when he got back to Koinonia and realized that the African-American kids didn't have bus transportation, and when it was time to harvest the crops, they were more often than not the ones that missed school. I think he felt strongly that needed to be changed. And I think the court decision in the early 1950s, Brown versus the Board of Education. I think that was something that was needed, and I think Koinonia, in some small way, could provide, if not instruction, at least transportation. Later on, it turned into summer camps and Bible studies that were open to all, and so in that way, provided education. Koinonia didn't have the ability or the resources or the people to have a home school that would have certainly been open. That's one of the interesting things now, is that there is a home school at Koinonia, and it is open to the community.
Well, and of course, the issue of desegregation in 1956, your dad's work to help a couple of students, African-American students, get into what is now known as Georgia State University is what sparked the violence against against the community.
Right.
You mentioned the yearbook spread from your senior year in the yearbook, and not knowing that was going to be in there until you received it. I wonder, what was your reaction when you saw that from your fellow students and friends?
Well, it was the initial emotion was very strong, but then I realized that really I hadn't just lost a father, but many of my classmates at the time felt like they had lost an advocate. And to this day, I get notes, and I've kept up with some of my high school friends, and they talk about what Koinonia meant to them. And at the time, many of their parents were afraid of the consequences, but they were already realizing that something was changing, and the Americus movement, the Albany movement, were all things that they identified with Koinonia.
Great. You know, we've talked a little bit about your father as a person, and you know, reading through his sermons and listening to some of them that have been preserved on tape, sure get a sense of someone who loved to tell a good story, who has just this great Southern wit, and just, you know, you're going along at one time being challenged and convicted, and the next moment I'm laughing and chuckling. And so I wonder how much of that kind of public persona helps us capture perhaps a glimpse of what he was on everyday life, this Southern charm and wit and storytelling that he seemed to have about him.
Well, I think, and you probably know as well as anyone, that you can tell a good story and get a point across in many times with humor and wit that otherwise might turn people off. And I think Daddy is not the only good Southern preacher that was able to tell stories and make things come alive, but he certainly used that storytelling ability. But he used it around us as kids. His stories of Old Coot had nothing to do with his translations or with the Bible. It was just good storytelling. And I think he honed those skills intentionally. I think he used it to diffuse animosity from face-to-face meetings with members of the Klan, to opportunities to instruct with humor.
You mentioned stories of Old Coot.
Coot was a mythical dog, and we would gather, all the kids in the community would gather for storytelling, and my dad would regale stories of Old Coot, who was an old hound dog with one green eye and one red eye, and he had lost one leg and had been fitted with a wheel. And you can imagine what a dog with a red and a green eye could do in a wheel to track down varmint and chase people that needed to be chased.
You know, that sounds like some really good stories. You know, the Cotton Patch Gospel, of course, is, and you made a reference to it, as something that he's well known for. And what I think is particularly interesting is reading through some of his sermons before those are being published, where he's playing with some of these stories in a little bit less of a strict translation. You know, in the Cotton Patch Gospel, he's very much trying to follow the storyline, but when he's given a sermon, sometimes he adds some more fun details to the stories, these biblical stories that he's retelling. And that just seems to be a really important part of his way of communicating, was trying to take these distant stories and make them fresh and new and alive for today's time.
Well, I think that's in a nutshell what he was trying to do, Brian. I think he wanted to make it inescapable. And so often you can listen to a sermon and it sounds like some faraway place. And I think the message was there, and making it inescapable for everyone. The Good Samaritan, how can you take that story and relate to it if it's left in the Middle East? But in the South, how can you miss the point of a guy lying beside the road and having a gospel band come by, having a well-known preacher come by? It's those types of things that he used and felt was really the way to get people to understand and make it real.
Yeah, and you know, that's the, you mentioned the Good Samaritan, and that was my first exposure to any of your father's work. I had a college professor who read that version, and it blew me away. And I think that there's something about particularly that parable that seems to continue to resonate with people, is it completely transforms the gospel story. We almost know it so well that we don't know it. He made us, your dad made us live it and try to pay attention to what was actually the point of the story.
Right, right. And I think over the years, some of his wording and all has lost a little bit, but you're right. That particular one is one that will remain fresh regardless of the language and the changes in words that are used and all. I think his goal was to make it lasting, and I think it's done that to a great extent. I think it's one of those things that it's probably gone much further than he ever envisioned.
Your dad was often referred to as prophet in blue jeans or a saint in overalls. And I wonder, although there's clearly remarkable things that he accomplished, I wonder if you could give us that side of him, of perhaps of any faults, that humanity of him. You know, because one of his big points was we have made Jesus so distant and divine that we've forgotten the humanity of him. And so I wonder if you can help us to remember the humanity, the imperfect, the human side of your dad as well.
Well, I think he would be the first to be disappointed if he felt people were putting him up on a pedestal, because that certainly was not his desire. And it was the real deal when he was home. When he spoke, he often had to wear a suit, depending on where he was. That was the given costume of the time. But once he got home and got on his old work boots and blue jeans, he was at home and really could be himself. And when people came, there was no, what they saw was the real thing. He didn't try and put on any different view when he was sitting at the table with visitors at lunch versus being at home standing at the counter washing dishes after a meal. It was just a matter of being himself. And you know, he would go down to his study and write, and it was a matter of today we'd look at it, well, he wrote most of his translations on scratch paper. It was old invoices from the pecan plant that Clint and he had purchased, and he didn't have the heart to throw them away, and he would handwrite his translations on those. And then he felt like I needed to learn how to type, and so he had a little Smith Corona electric typewriter, and he'd bring two or three pages up from his study and say, okay, type these for me, and I would type them, and he'd go through and correct them, and then he threw those pieces of paper out. But it was just trying to, he wrestled with every word that he translated, because he did want it to be a natural thing and wanted people to understand it very simply. He didn't feel like there was a combination to the lock to understanding the Bible. He felt like if it could be translated into something that everyone understood, that was all the better.
When I was going through the archives, it was very exciting to see some of those scraps and those notes that he was doing from the cotton patch, to see the Greek and see some typed copies, perhaps some of the ones that you typed, and then handwritten changes and edits, and to see this as a process of, as he's creating this document was very fascinating to see that. And the notes just everywhere. You're right. I can definitely see this idea of not wanting to throw out paper. I actually even found a couple letters from Martin Luther King Jr. to your father. And on the backside of one of them, he had written some notes completely unrelated to King, doing some counting and some numbers and so forth. Just a fascinating personal perspective there.
Right. Well, and I think that's really who he was. It wasn't he really labored over the translations much more than we ever realized. He used the community as a sounding block. He would translate, and then at a community meeting would read it, and it would be discussed, and he would make changes based on input from those in the community. It wasn't his way only. He really was looking for feedback to make it real.
Well, I really appreciate this time we've had to talk, and I wonder, is there something that I haven't asked about or that we haven't talked about that to you is really important in understanding who your father was as a father, as a person, as a figure who impacted so many lives?
Brian, I think the one thing that I would just like to get across, and as we approach his 100th birthday celebration and the 70th anniversary of Koinonia, I think it is amazing the transformation that has taken place in Americas, in Sumter County. Not that there's still many things that could be changed and improved and made the more equal and just, but I think he would be very honored at the changes that came about. I don't think he would feel like he had caused those changes, but I think there's a message there of forgiveness that sometimes we overlook, and he would be the first to acknowledge that and accept those changes from the local folks. That isn't a real answer to your question that you just asked me, but I want to get that across, that Koinonia has always been a demonstration plot, and you can plant seeds, and sometimes it takes a long time for them to grow and mature, and that is something that would be probably as important in his mind, that those seeds had taken root in that old red Georgia clay and brought about real change.
Well, that's great. And thanks again for giving us some time today.
Okay, thank you.